It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Land Bank was created 7 years ago to fix up, sell, and get hundreds of abandoned houses and other buildings back onto city tax rolls. But thus far, the Land Bank hasn't been meeting benchmarks or kept up with similar programs. Now there's a change in leadership. The Urban Redevelopment Authority Board has confirmed URA Deputy Executive Director Diamante Walker to lead the land bank and hired Greg Miller, a senior urban designer for New York City, as manager of the land bank. Diamante Walker, welcome back to the Confluence.
Good morning, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
Diamante, last August, Mayor Bill Peduto told WESA the land bank is, quote, one of the failures of his administration. Do you think the land bank has been a failure to this point?
I personally don't think that the land bank has been a failure to this point. I think that we have been, you know, working to try to figure out how it could be right-sized and become the right program for Pittsburgh. But I do understand the sentiment and the frustration. One of the things that I've been doing at the URA is really rethinking land recycling and how we could. The URA is a bigger redevelopment authority. It's not a land bank, but there's so much consanguinity and so much shared vision and mission around wanting to see an equitable land recycling strategy in the city of Pittsburgh. So we began thinking about what could be done to position the land bank to actually deliver the results that everybody had intended when the tool was developed.
My colleague at WESA, Margaret J. Krause, reported as of the end of 2020, the land bank had yet to buy, clear, and sell a single property. Is that still the case? And if so, what's the holdup?
So that is the case. I want to be fully transparent with you and your audience. And so, you know, one of the challenges that we've had is that when the land bank acquires property, it also has the responsibility of stewardship. And so there's a lot of property that would need to be acquired and the title would need to be cleared. And we did not have, the fungible resources to be able to do that at any level of scale. And so we, you know, the board last month approved a contract to allow that title clearing process to happen. And one of the things that I've commissioned as the new executive director is that we take that very first property that has sort of been stuck in that vicious cycle, that we start to move that through the process. And as of yesterday, I got a very promising update that we've made traction and that we're going to start to see properties move and that the land bank will become, again, as I said, more operational.
How many properties are we talking about approximately that have to have the titles cleared so they can move forward?
We have, I think 1,700 across the entire portfolio for the URA, many more at the city. I can get you the exact number. I think it's around 14,000, give or take, of tax delinquent properties that need some level of redress. And, one of the big barriers that we're facing right now are the municipal tax liens that are on the properties because they've been underperforming for so long. So we are working to build partnerships with the three taxing bodies to bring them to the table and to have a really thoughtful conversation around how do we work together in order to bring these properties back to productive use, but do it in a way that is going to be inclusive of community voice, community priority, and, you know, most importantly, to eliminate blight and create beautiful spaces for people to have a good quality of life.
And of course, the three taxing bodies are the municipality, Allegheny County, and the school district. A land bank has some special abilities. While the city has to accept, I believe, the highest bid for a property, a land bank can sell the land for a lower bid, but a proposal that benefits a neighborhood. Now, the land bank has worked with the URA through a memo of understanding. Now the plan is to have the URA take a larger role through you in management of the land bank. What is that going to involve?
So what that involves is really being able to keep the overhead of the land bank low while it gets its legs, and to give it the full breadth of knowledge and capability available at the URA, but being able to look at these deals through an equitable and community neighborhood scale lens.
You mentioned keeping or reducing overhead. There have been some concerns about how the land bank had been spending money. Are you going to prioritize transparency in spending?
I don't know any other way to do it. So I think that we have to be transparent. We've got to be vocal about what the resources are and what the resources are not. And so, you know, the land bank spent a lot of, you know, money and resources trying to understand and build a knowledge bank of understanding of what's working around the country. So I don't want folks to feel like money was spent and the money was spent for naught. The money was invested in building the collateral that will allow executive leadership and a staff to advance those recommendations and those objectives forward.
A nearby land bank, the Tricog Land Bank, it works in about two dozen municipalities near the city, from East Pittsburgh to Aetna to Millville to Sharpsburg to Rankin and many others. That land bank seems to be having success in revitalizing properties. What's the difference?
If you look at the Tricog Land Bank, they have tremendous leadership and staff that wake up every day thinking about how to make that land bank successful. And all folks are working in partnership with the community. I believe that that's a viable model, and that's the model that Pittsburgh would like to emulate. We have a couple of, you know, different challenges because of the three taxing body structure here. And we know that in order for a land bank to be successful, those relationships have to be holistic and they have to be working well. And so that is what we are committed to doing now.
So Greg Miller, senior urban designer for New York City, has been appointed to manage the land bank. Specifically, what do you think he brings?
He's from Pittsburgh, so he's from the area. So I think that he brings that hometown knowledge, that hometown pride and feel of what it means to manage 90 plus neighborhoods. I think that his background in urban design and zoning and construction is going to help do what the land bank really needs, which is to actually implement, to actually look at this from a project by project, opportunity by opportunity basis. And I can't think of anybody, you know, at this juncture better than Greg Miller to help lead that charge.
Finally, the idea is to return land to the control of neighborhood groups and residents to help meet priorities in their community. Could be building affordable housing, creating urban farms, parklets, what have you. What are you hearing from communities, from people that are supposed to benefit from the land bank? Impatience, frustration, something else?
So I actually hear optimism and vision, but I think that it is wrapped up in a thread of frustration and agitation because the tool has not been working. They have the answers. They're not waiting for us to answer the problems. They're waiting for us to kind of get out of the way and make the tools work better. I don't want to delude anybody. This is going to be an uphill battle. We need to be prioritized within the budget. We need state support. We need federal support. And we need the cooperation of the three taxing bodies. I think that the community is there and they're ready to play ball. And it's up to us to how we want to meet that challenge.
Diamante Walker is the executive director of the Pittsburgh Land Bank and deputy executive director of the Urban Redevelopment Authority. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Pirates home opener this afternoon against the Chicago Cubs will be different than last year's, as well as the 2019 opener. Fans will be back in the stands today, but it won't be a full house because of pandemic restrictions. Stephen Perkins is the Executive Vice President of Marketing and Fan Engagement for the Pirates. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin. Excited to be here.
Stephen, how difficult was it specifically for you and more broadly for the organization to keep fans engaged in last year's shortened season when there weren't fans in the stands?
It's incredibly challenging. You know, when we think about sports, it really is about that live entertainment experience. And not being able to provide that is a difficult challenge. For us, it's about thinking about how we can extend our brand story and that game day experience through other channels, like digital channels. And I think the organization did a really strong strong approach to that last year. And we're looking to build onto that as we go forward.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me maybe one example of what you learned last year that you can still and want to still incorporate this year as people are moving back into the ballpark in limited numbers?
Well, there's things like, you know, we all know about the Great Pittsburgh Pierogi Race. That is a piece of this brand and a part of this brand that we know that people love. So this year we're actually moving it to the Clemente Bridge. It's going to be run on the bridge, and we're going to record it live and actually air it the day after the game, so fans can go on our ballpark app and they can watch that race themselves. So while they may not be able to attend the game, they can still experience, you know, that critical moment, that pivotal moment of coming to PNC Park. We have a new, really cool sort of fantasy baseball offering that's coming out this year called Pick Three. You can pick three players, and obviously, depending on their performance, you earn points, and those points ultimately can pay off in terms of prizing and promotional items.
Governor Wolf recently eased restrictions on outdoor events, allowing for a maximum of 50% capacity. The Pirates have decided on capping attendance at 25%. Why so?
Well, I think planning around events like Major League Baseball games are they're large endeavors, right? The planning around that capacity number is something that's happened for a while. You know, organizationally, you know, we're actively engaged with the governor's office and other leaders in the community trying to think about how we can begin to expand that ticket offering beyond the capacity limit that we have right now.
Mm-hmm. So 162 game season this year, back to normal, 81 games at home. So are you looking to possibly expand that 25% to a higher amount as the season goes on, or is it going to be 25% for the entire season?
That's the goal. I mean, obviously, I think we've all learned through COVID and everything that we've all gone through, it's really hard to predict the future, clearly. Ultimately, we do want to be able to offer full seating, full capacity to our fans.
Pirates president Travis Williams said that one option the team is considering to bump attendance and maybe work around the social distancing is vaccination sections. Williams said he was discussing this with the governor's office. Do we know where those discussions stand? Is that still a possibility, a vaccination section?
I think those conversations are still ongoing. You know, Travis is actively working with the governor's office, as you mentioned. And I think ultimately, if that's something that we'd be able to offer, we certainly will.
I understand no single tickets. They're sold in pods of two or four.
Yep.
Purchased and received digitally. Is that correct?
This year, we're moving to fully digital ticketing. You know, the way that works is you download the MLB ballpark app. You pick your favorite team once you do it, and you can manage your tickets, whether they're single game, season tickets, or group tickets, all through that app. It's very easy to do.
Face masks. Those are going to be required. Will ushers enforce this? I mean, how strict are you going to be about face masks?
Yeah, there will be enforcement of that face mask rule at the park, you know, given that it is, you know, part of a mandate. It is going to be a primary focus for us. And, you know, we want to make sure that we're providing that safe environment.
One tradition you won't be able to observe before games, the kids, the fans standing along the railings hoping for an autograph.
When you think about what makes baseball great, you know, that doesn't happen in any other sport. Man, I can't wait for the day when we're able to do that again.
Stephen Perkins is the Executive Vice President of Marketing and Fan Engagement for the Pirates. Stephen, thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new program aims to help Black artists make Pittsburgh's music ecosystem more equitable. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll reports the residency supports musicians who teach as well as create their own work.
An opera is a story, and all of the words are sung.
Lynn Starr is teaching a half dozen five-year-olds on Zoom. The class is called Opera Tots, run by Pittsburgh Festival Opera. Starr is wearing a backwards ball cap. He asks the kids to unmute their computers and repeat after him.
An opera is a story, and all of the words are sung.
And all the
songs. Yes, okay, Rubica, you're awesome, see?
The class lasts 30 minutes, and kids drift in and out of the frame. It's challenging, but teaching isn't all Star does.
Oh,
That star singing opera in Italian. The 25-year-old grew up on the North Side and studied vocal performance at St. Vincent College. He's also a composer and performer with quite a range across styles. Here's a song of his own, 96 Corolla.
Praises to the Most High. Park my red face to the night sky.
He's performed at the former Console Energy Center and once opened for hip-hop stars Bone Thugs and Harmony. Star likes teaching, but wishes he didn't have to do it quite so much to earn a living. So when he heard about the new Black Teaching Artist in Residence program, he applied right away.
The key thing is having more time to work on my own artistry, because that's something that the Black Teaching Artist Residence offers, is, I guess, a budget in order for you to actually just live and thrive without actually having to constantly work and constantly, you know, contract yourself as a teaching artist.
The residency is the brainchild of Act 3 Consulting Partners, a local company that works with arts groups and community organizations. The company teamed with Unisound, a coalition of groups that foster youth music in Pittsburgh. The residency lasts 7 months. It includes a $1,000 monthly stipend and help with professional development. Kendra Ross is a partner in Act 3.
You know, there's so many amazing Black musicians and teaching artists in Pittsburgh who, you know, are not able, first of all, to practice their art as much as they would like because there are not that many opportunities for them to do so, right? We believe that artists are going to be that much more powerful in the classroom if they themselves are able to invest time in their own art and their own practice.
Star was accepted into the program. His goals include taking his show on the road.
I would love to tour nationally. I would love to actually, you know, leave the city with my art and actually just go somewhere and show people what I'm capable of.
The program's other inaugural artist is Brittany Trotter, a flutist. She grew up in small town Mississippi.
I was inspired by my band director. She was a Black woman, and just seeing her just like doing all of these cool things really inspired me to continue on with my musical training.
Trotter performs with local groups. She also teaches woodwinds like sax and clarinet. One of her goals is to create a combination lecture and recital that incorporates elements of hip-hop into classical music. She's also looking to produce updated written instructional materials that include popular hip-hop and R&B numbers.
I teach kids from as young as 5 to as old as 67, and most of the flute method book goes into folk tunes, but like these folk tunes, none of my kids heard of them because it's not like in their musical vocabulary growing up, and they can't really relate to it. And so I wanted to bring in music that they can relate to and that they listen to.
Vocalist Lynn Starr, too, says the residency program will pay dividends not only for the artists, but also for Unisound and other groups who work in the Black community.
Well, I am a Black teaching artist who can help let them know what we actually need, what people in our communities actually need. It gives me a seat at the table and it gives me a voice.
The inaugural Black Teaching Artist in Residence program continues into August. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.